وأغدو على القوت يا زهيدي، كما غدا الزل تهداه والتنائف أتحلو، غدا طويا يعارض الريح هافيا يخوط بأذناب شعابي ويعسلو. Despite my meager fare, I cross the dark to hunt, like the ravenous lean-hipped, spleen-dark wolf of the wastes, who lopes along sideways against the wind, sniffing for prey as he speeds through the tail ends of ravines.
Welcome to The Lead, the New Lines magazine podcast. I'm Lydia Wilson, and this is a podcast where we delve into the biggest ideas, events, and personalities from around the world. Before Islam took it all over the world, Arabic was only spoken in the Arabian Peninsula, within a tribal society that left few written records. The period is called Jahiliya, or ignorance in Arabic, suggesting a sharp dividing line between pre- and post-Islam recorded in the language. But the label of ignorance did not mean they did not have a rich literary tradition. Far from it. What you just heard was a few lines of poetry from the very cusp of Islam, a poet who spanned the Jahiliya and Islamic periods. Poetry was central to the lifestyle and remains a major source for us now, giving insights into this time and society. Recent translations into English bring these insights to a much wider public. You just heard the voice of James Montgomery, one of the translators and champions of the genre, the Sir Thomas Adams Professor of Arabic at the University of Cambridge and a founding member of the editorial board of the Library of Arabic Literature. His research and translations have spanned pre-Islamic poetry to 9th century philosophy, taking in many other topics along the way. But today we're going to be discussing one particular genre that lasted in Arabic for centuries and is still celebrated and recited today. Poetry about hunting. James Montgomery, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Lydia. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, can you give us a quick idea as to what Jahiliya is and how you became to be interested in it?
So Jahiliya, as you said in your intro, possibly means a period of ignorance. Another translation, ignorance of Islam, that would be. So the centuries that in Arabia that precede the advent of Islam. Other scholars have proposed the period of barbarism, where one of the related meanings of the word jahil, that forms the word jahiliya, is to behave in a uncivilized, primitive, uncontrolled manner. The theory that I like the best, I suppose, is the one that proposes that Jahiliya means a period where the most important feature of the society was vendetta and taking revenge, and that there were no holds or limits to the individual or the tribe in exacting retribution for bloodshed. So I think somewhere in between ignorance, barbarism, and vendetta-ism probably lies the answer.
That sounds like a harsh life. What are the sources apart from poetry do we have for all of these characterizations of the time?
All of our sources are post-Islamic.
Right.
The poetry, of course, was kept alive for a couple of centuries through tribal memory, but then was codified and written down by scholars in the 8th century in Iraq, in Basra and Kufa. So we rely entirely on Islamic sources about the pre-Islamic period, except for inscriptions on stone, rock drawings. Perhaps now an increasing number of archaeological sites are starting to unearth artifacts and so on. But effectively, the poetry is our portal on to the world. So we have to interpret the world through the poetry, and the poetry is the only thing we have to go on in order to establish this world. So there's a real circular logic to that well, let's exercise.
Let's get straight into the poetry then. Your first book of hunting poetry, not your first book, was called Fate the Hunter.
Yes.
So can you actually explain the title?
Well, the title is actually a quote from one of the translations of one of the lines in the book. I chose it largely because it seemed to sum up precisely to me, after reading this material for 40 years, what the beating heart of the corpus is. And that is that man and humans and human society, being transitory, being ephemeral, being doomed to die, is in constant war against a great impersonal force that the poetry determines as ad-dahr, which in Arabic means time. I tried experimenting with time in the translations, but it's not so value-laden a word in English as fate. And so I sort of used the connotations that English has of fate in order to bring out this sense of a force greater than ourselves that exerts control over every aspect of our lives, and everything that we do, that we are effectively powerless to resist because it is so all-encompassing. But equally, the value of the human being lies precisely in the resistance, however futile, because it's possible that as time was conceived to be circular, that one might turn the circle of time or fate from adversity to good times again, from insecurity to security. But the real value of the human lay in the extent to which the human could participate and resist this inexorable circularity of misfortune and good fortune.
Now, the second part of your title is early.
Yes.
Hunting poetry.
Yes.
And that spans this sharp dividing line that I mentioned in the introduction from the Jahiliyyah to the Islamic period.
Yes.
But what it seems to me is that conception of circularity of time and fate does change with the religion of Islam. And I wondered if this division into pre- and post-Islam is actually reflected in the poems that you translated. What do you see that shows evidence of the coming of Islam?
One can determine in early Islamic poetry, relics from the pre-Islamic past, the presence of the new Islamic present, and an amalgamation of both the past and the present. So there is no consistent pattern to this. Just as because the poetry comes from so many different regions and represents the outlook of so many different human beings, we all put together the present and the past differently at different times in the course of life, and perhaps even in different places. So I see in this that one can have pre-existing currents that continue to exist in the poetry. And in terms of the hunting poetry, when we get to the more developed, fully Islamic centuries, the old concept of time or fate persists alongside the new concept of the omniscient, omnipotent God. But the great thing is, and the wise thing about the poetry, is it doesn't seek to reconcile the two. It allows both to coexist. It's always understood that God is, of course, in control of fate. But no one, to my knowledge, I've not found a case yet where someone actually says explicitly that this is exactly so. There's a sense that both ideas can coexist. And then in the final volume of the series of four of this that I'm currently working on, I've gone quite far to in time to show that this old notion of fate, of time, still persists, often in some of the most ostensibly pious of poets.
Oh, that is fascinating that we can trace so much through poetry. Well, let's get on to some of the later ones then before we start tracking what's similar. Your most recent book, I think just published this month, in fact, is In Deadly Embrace, which is also hunting poetry, but written much later. The poems are by the 9th century poet and caliph for just one day.
Yes.
Ibn al-Mu'tas. First, can you tell me a little bit about him?
Okay, he's an absolutely fascinating individual, Ibn al-Mu'tas, for so many reasons. Largely, as much for his life as for the misconstruction subsequently of his life. It's often a truism that history is written by the victors. And Ibn al-Mu'tas was appointed caliph for one day before a palace revolt removed him from his caliphacy, and he died in the process. So he's obviously one of the losers in the narrative arc of history. And so history recast him as a aristocratic playboy who was interested in nothing but the good life, the soft life, poetry. He wrote the first work on Arabic rhetoric to have survived, called the Kitab al-Badi'ah, the book of the new style, where he tries to show that stylistic advances in Arabic poetry have their predecessors in pre-Islamic poetry, but above all in the Quran. And that was very, very influential. He wrote a book in which he collected the works of all the so-called modernist poets, the poets who represented this Badi'a novel, unusual style. But above all, he survives by virtue of his poetry. Mm. A large part of his poetry, which is in all of the major genres, love poetry, poetry about wine, poetry about friends and friendship, descriptive poetry. One of the significant genres of his poetry is, in fact, poetry devoted to the hunt. And what fascinated me about his hunting poetry was why a playboy aristocrat would want to take part in something as dangerous and as demanding and as, shall we say, masculine as the hunt. Mm. And that led me to reconsider Ibn al-Mu'tas's career as every much the aspiring politician. He belonged to the inner core of the ruling Abbasid family. And I started to see his hunting poetry as an expression almost of his political demeanour, and not quite the palace wastrel that he had been presented as by subsequent generations.
Right, but it's still in a very, very different context from the deserts of Arabia, isn't it? Whatever his character was, we're now in a court setting in very sophisticated Baghdad, in the yes. Abbasid courts,
yes.
With very strict rules of etiquette, and yes. It's a sophisticated society. And so that is very far. Even if they are still hunting, it's not the hunting of the deserts of the 6th and 7th centuries. So what's remained the same about the poetry?
Well, I would disagree slightly, because the hunting in Iraq would have taken place in empty desert wastes and scrublands, perhaps not in the hard desert of Arabia, such as the great northern desert of Nafud in the north of Arabia. Although I'm not sure that many of my poems actually stem quite so simplistically and automatically from the desert. But Ibn al-Mu'tas and his companions would have gone on hunting expeditions that would have involved leaving Baghdad, going out into the surrounding countryside, into the scrublands and agricultural heartlands of Iraq. They would have camped out and overnighted. And so in that sense, I don't see much of a difference, because however, how one hunts is determined by what one hunts. Mm-hmm. And it's not quite like the situation, let's say, in Britain, where there were hunting preserves that were maintained. The forest was the preserve of the king. In order for the king to hunt the stags were managed. There was a great sort of ecological endeavour to maintain the environment in order to allow the hunting to take place. Often, for example, when Queen Elizabeth the First went hunting, she would be positioned in a safe place with a bow and arrow, and the stags and deer would have been corralled and pushed towards the area where she could sort of kill them from her convenience. I think, yep. You know, so that's, but that's because one can, as it were, corral or herd deer in that way. If one is out hunting the onager, the wild desert ass, or if one is hunting the oryx, which are true desert creatures, one can't quite corral them in the same way. Although there is in examples in the Jordanian desert of what are called kites, which are areas for constructions for channeling wildlife so that they could be more easily killed by the royalty. But my sense from my imaginative reconstruction of the hunting of Ibn al-Mu'taz from his poetry is that this was more of a, as it were, hands-on active activity, a more physical hunt than simply sitting on a platform with a bow and arrow waiting to take aim at some unfortunate animal that happened to be within range. And that is, I think, because the iconography and the ritual of hunting in this very sophisticated courtly society was in order to qualify a prince not only for war, ready him for war, but also to qualify him as a potential leader. And those are deep, ancient Persian, Sasanian ideas about the royal hunt.
And the qualities needed. You were demonstrating the qualities you needed.
Yes.
Well, that all brings me to a very different question, because about hunting and about understanding the hunt.
Yes.
It's about the research you needed to do, because the translations are full of technical terms to do with animals. Yes. Animals we might not even know. Maybe they don't even exist anymore.
Yeah.
And also equipment. Yes. Lots and lots of technical to do with weapons or horse riding or whatever. How do you even begin to do this research?
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, because I first started this project 30 years ago, I think.
Right.
I was working on a poet, Abu Firas al-Hamdani, who is a contemporary of the great poet al-Mutanabbi in the 10th century. Abu Firas was at the Hamdanid court of Saif ad-Dawla, who was a great champion in the 10th century of the war against the Byzantines. And Abu Firas himself was, like Ibn al-Mu'taz, aristocratic born, prince, courtier, poet, warrior. I think he had his first governorship at the age of 16. He was captured in battle and he was held prisoner in Byzantium, i.e. what we now call Istanbul, and is famous for a long series of poems that he wrote to his cousin, the ruler, Saif ad-Dawla, asking him to pay the ransom that he be released. But Saif ad-Dawla, perhaps sensing a rival to the throne, was in no hurry to have his cousin back in court. And these poems were known as the Rumiyat, the poems from Rome, i.e. from Byzantium, Constantinople, Istanbul. And in the course of reading through this poet's work, I came across a very long poem, some 250 verses. It was tucked away at the end of the book, and it wasn't in one of the mainstream Arabic meters. So there are 16 Arabic meters that are recognized for proper poetry. And then there's a more popular form of meter known as rajas, which refers to the quivering of a camel's tail, in which a lot of extemporary compositions were set. And I tried to make my way through this rajas poem. And it was as if I had suddenly did not know Arabic at all. The vocabulary was so strange. The objects that were being described were so unfamiliar. I couldn't understand which bird of prey he was referring to. And you have to know the bird of prey, or sometimes you have to know the identity of the prey in order to establish the bird of prey, or the bird of prey to identify the range of prey that you're going to encounter. And my interest was so piqued and so stimulated, and also my sense that I thought that I had, after 10 years of reading Arabic, a reasonably good grasp of some aspects of the language. But to be confronted after 10 years of study with something that was just so opaque really stimulated my curiosity.
And that's what led you to spending the next 30 years delving into this subject.
Almost, but not quite, because I tried. I acquired books on birds of prey. I acquired handbooks on the ornithology of the Middle East, of Arabia and so on. But I couldn't really get enough information that I could feel comfortable with. I eventually wrote this up in an article about 25 years ago, but I decided then that I would go no further because there just weren't the resources available to me. I wasn't at a stage in my life where I could easily jump on a train and go and visit a raptor centre and try and talk to falconers. But then 10, 12 years ago, when I was encouraged to revisit this by a poem that I saw in a museum in Abu Dhabi, I realized that YouTube and the internet was what this project needed. I couldn't do it without the online resource of amateur falconers filming themselves, of chat groups, of websites. There's the International Falconers Association that you can use. And then that gave me access to a kind of community of experts. And until really maybe 50 years ago, when we worked out how to artificially inseminate falcons and hawks, the breed hadn't changed at all. So there was the way that the falcon was behaving in 1969 was the way it would have behaved in 965 wherever.
Yeah.
And so the internet was what really made it possible for me to really do this project to the level of confidence that I had, that I wasn't simply, I mean, I've made plenty of mistakes in these books. I know I have, because I'm an armchair enthusiast.
You haven't been hunting with falcons because of all of these contacts.
No, I haven't. I haven't been in a hunting expedition, but I do have some.
You should.
I do have some good friends who are expert falconers, and they've been very generous with their time. But one of the problems that in the poetry that got me stuck the most is there's a lot of poems about hunting with what's called the pellet bow. And this was where the internet actually sent me the wrong way, because I came across a website about the varieties of handheld bows. Of course, all bows are handheld, but a handheld bow is effectively like a catapult or a slingshot or whatever. And so I left those poems to the very end because I needed to do so much more work on them. But I always had in my mind an image of someone holding a crossbow. And no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get the poems to work. And then I came across, totally by accident, the most amazing video by some Turkish archers who were experimenting with pellet bows. And the pellet bows they were using were exactly like the bow that you would use with bows and arrows. The only difference is that you use very small, hard-baked pellets. And they were interested in testing velocity and speed and directionality and techniques of bow holding so that, you know.
What do you mean pellet, though? How can you shoot a pellet with a bow?
Because.
How do you hold it?
Because the string has a pouch.
Okay. Oh, pouch. Yes.
And the pellet fits in the pouch.
Yeah.
And you hold the pouch in between your thumb and your forefinger or your second finger and pull it back.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, you have to angle your hand in such a way that the pellet doesn't break your thumb as it leaves the string.
So you hold on to the pouch and let the pellet go, basically?
Yes.
Oh, that's very tricky.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, it was a real eureka moment for me because all of the poems made sense. All of the descriptions of the bows and the construction of the bows that I couldn't do in terms of the crossbow made sense to me. And that was because I had a half an hour to spare and I was wasting time.
On YouTube.
So, yes, on YouTube, as we do, you know, trying to avoid the cat videos. And up came this video about the bows.
So sometimes the algorithms work in our favour, even when we're trying to understand Jahliya poetry.
Yes, yeah. But really, the sum and total of it is that the information that is contained on the web was the difference between being interested in this material and being confident enough to think that I could make a respectable stab at it.
Oh, well, it's a real insight into kind of continuity of tradition. And I mean, I can understand how useful that was, but when I read these poems, they're an extraordinary and very beautiful insight into a completely alien world. So it can't have only come from contemporary falconry. There are other things in this material that don't make me think about being in the Arabian Gulf that I've been to. And so how well do you think you can understand a 6th century hunter from this YouTube information?
Yeah.
Because you have, you've brought to life a way of life that doesn't feel at all familiar to someone like me.
Yeah, that's interesting. And of course, it's a huge leap of the imagination, but we have a terrible tendency in the 21st century to think that imagination is effectively untrammeled and nothing but make-believe. Imagination, as far as I can see, requires a huge amount of mental discipline before it can be allowed to work its magic.
Yeah.
So for me, it was really important to try to know as much about the what we call the realia, the everyday real aspects of this material, in order then to compile a distinct enough a data set in my mind that would then enable me to try to enter into the poetic universe of the poetry. And then by doing that, I mean, of course, I could just have been contented myself with the academic solution, which would have been to write a very dry monograph about all of this, where I go into all the details and it sits on the library shelf and maybe the occasional PhD student will read it. But I thought, no, I want to use this knowledge to try to make the poetry come alive. Mm-hmm. And of course, the fact that the poetry does come alive is largely down to the poetry, but it's also down to me because I've made the effort in order to bring the poetry to life. And I've often found myself, I guess, not cheating as much, but and not cutting corners. So I chose fate as an example of this. I chose fate over time because fate has the right resonances in English. And so my translation aspires to be very heavily grounded in English and possibly European North American, Anglo-American consciousness in such a way that paradoxically it creates the space for the poetry to breathe through all of this.
Well, we're getting onto massive questions of translation here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the quote that everybody always uses at this point, I'm going to follow the lead, sorry, is Shelley in defense of poetry.
Uh-huh.
And he writes, "It were as wise to cast a violet into a crucible that you might discover the formal principles of its color and odor as to seek to transfuse from one language into another the creation of a poet."
Yes.
What would you say to Shelley?
I would agree with him because he's absolutely right. If I tried to create poetry out of this, I would be doing the material an injustice.
Right.
So my intention is, in a sense, to create a space in which, through the careful and judicious use of English, I do not make it impossible for some echoes of the Arabic original to echo through.
Right. So you think of the job as providing almost a landscape for it to stand in. No, that's not right.
I think of it, this is perhaps the best analogy I can think of at the moment. There are those people who say that, let's say you can only listen to a Mozart piano sonata if it's played on the type of piano that Mozart would have existed in Mozart's day, or even better, only on Mozart's piano.
Yeah.
But then you have to become Mozart in order to achieve that. And, you know, I don't dislike it, but I don't like listening, for example, to Bach on the harpsichord. I much prefer listening to Bach on the piano. And the piano and the pianist simply makes it possible for the magic that is in Bach's notation, which is already a form of distilling the music, to sound through.
Yeah.
So in other terms that people use, I mean, I domesticate the poems in order to allow them to have the opportunity to rebel against that domestication.
What do you mean by domestication? Can you give any examples?
Now wishing I hadn't used that word. There is a debate... was a debate that was quite popular 50, maybe 20 years ago. Perhaps it still is in translation studies about whether one domesticates a language one is translating. We would now say perhaps colonize, to put it in more contemporary terms, or whether one allows all of its strangeness and otherness and alienness to be the basic point of the translation. And it's connected with notions of invisible and visible translators. So the invisible translator is the translator who seeks not to be noticed when going about her job. The visible translator is the one that tends to draw attention to herself and her interventions in the text. And invisible translators tend to domesticate, and invisible translators tend to do what the opposite of domesticating is, which I've forgotten at the moment, but to alienate or defamiliarize the text. Now, there's something useful in all of those discussions, and they're important discussions. I don't mean to be glib or flippant about them. But what I've experienced doing this, particularly working for a project like the Library of Arabic Literature, which is predicated upon domestication. It's predicated upon the production of lucid modern English texts. What I've discovered is that through creating enough room in the domestication process, it's domesticating without neutering or enslaving reducing the poem to its to the barriers that I've put upon it.
I mean, I wonder then if we could talk about process to make this a little bit less abstract.
Yes.
Because I know that you've experimented a lot and the whole Library of Arabic Literature Board has experimented with translating poetry using poets who don't speak Arabic.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about the processes you've experimented with to come up with your translations.
Yeah. Well, we originally, when we started out in 2010, thought that the best way in which to do this would be to have an Arabist and a poet working side by side and producing a translation of poetry. Interestingly, all of those experiments, none of them really properly worked.
But you got a lot out of them, I thought. I remember some stories about workshopping.
Yes, we then decided that we had to try to work out why they weren't working. What we could do in order to make them work, if at all possible. So we organized a series of workshops in New York and in Abu Dhabi, and we invited various colleagues, some of whom knew Arabic, some of whom didn't know Arabic. They all were highly accomplished, prize-winning translators and poets in their own right, all had taught translation professionally at university level. Of course, we're talking about literary translation here. That's an important thing to bear in mind. And we experimented under their guidance with various ways of approaching it. And what came out of that for me was a sense of the sort of things that were possible, the sort of techniques that one could try.
Like what? I mean, you'd already done a huge amount of translation because you'd been translating all sorts of Abbasid texts, philosophical, all the rest of it.
And,
so arriving in that kind of situation with your kind of more academic approach and with your poetry, then what was the experience like of being workshopped in that way? Poets are used to being workshopped when everybody sits around tearing their stuff apart. It's part of learning how to be a poet.
Yeah, well, that's actually, I guess, what happened, because academics are not used to being workshopped.
No.
They don't like it at all.
Tell me what
they
it was like.
They do not like. On the first workshop, we'd been set some poems to translate. By Philip Kennedy had chosen one or two. And I volunteered to attempt a translation. Of course, I had rendered lots of Arabic poems into English before, and I'm not using the word translate here entirely on purpose.
Okay.
I had Englished them in monographs, in scholarly articles.
Sounds violent, English them.
Yes. Well, I think it was. I think it was definitely the one guiding impulse throughout all of that process of Englishing was that I should show that I understood the Arabic, that no one could criticize me as an academic for misunderstanding the Arabic. So most academic Englishing or Germanizing or however, whatever one wants to say, and I'm desperately not going to use the word translate here. Most of these academic versions are not about the poem itself. They're about the academic's authority, her standing, her need to display to the community her command of the material. And of course, this was how I'd been taught to do it. It's how I had done it for about 30 years up to that point. And this is what I offered these poets who were experts in the demolition job of workshopping. And I sat with these poets, but also my friends and colleagues in the Library of Arabic Literature, all of whom I respected. And I watched my Englished version be torn apart. It was taken apart word by word, piece by piece, and it was left in absolute an absolute shambles at the end. And at first I thought, do you know, I can throw a hissy fit and get all upset, or I can just embrace this. What an opportunity. Here are some people whom I deeply admire for their skills and their humanity, They're giving freely of their knowledge, of their learning. They are doing this not with a view to produce destructive criticism, but constructive criticism. And the moment that clicked with me, the moment I really said, and actually what happened then, I would have been in my 50s at the time. And in the course of that afternoon, I went back to remembering an 18-year-old self who wanted to be a poet. And I went back to a naive, inexperienced young man that got cold feet and decided that the scholarly approach to literature was one that he felt safer with and possibly could hide behind. Yeah. And those years were sort of stripped away from me. And then we were asked to, each of us at the end of the session, to go through and produce our own versions of this poem, to retranslate it for me, but for everyone else to produce their versions. And we had one member of the group with a computer tied into a projector. And we went around the group line by line and typed it out. And so we had 13, 14, maybe 15 different versions.
Line by line.
Line by line of the poem, side by side. And it was really very, very revealing for everyone. And in the course of that, I felt strangely liberated because one of the frustrations I'd felt as an academic, and one of the reasons that after spending so much time studying pre-Islamic poetry that I had abandoned it and turned to other subjects, was a profound frustration with myself at being unable somehow to capture in words what got me excited or what I loved about this poetry, what I found exciting, what I found just simply mind-altering. And I realized then that actually I should redefine the future trajectory of my career more with a view to exploring poetry as a mechanism of, I don't want to say academic commentary, but as a, excuse me, as a tradition or as an experimentation in engagement rather than an experimentation and documentation.
Well, I think that is where the difference lies, you know, that safety that you described about academia, the hiding behind. There's something about notions of accuracy and attention to detail in research and research writing that leads to incredibly literal translations
yes.
that other people can assess for accuracy.
Yes.
And the accuracy is to do with meaning.
Yes.
And that's not where poetry lies. A poem should not mean but be.
Yes.
I can't remember who said that. Was it E.E. Cummings?
Yeah.
Anyway, that sticks in my mind as what poetry is. And I think that is very scary for an academic. But if you just let it go, I can see how liberating it is. But also that 13 or 14 or 15 versions of line by line by line, that's also liberating because you can see what poetry can be,
yes.
which is huge, and
yes.
you can't include it all.
No.
You've got to pick your own.
No, it's very true. I would say the same applies to prose also. Pedagogically, in my experience in the classroom, students will respond a lot more positively to a translation that is not a line-for-line crib. Because the problems that they have in understanding the Arabic, once you get past what does this word mean, how does this sentence fit together, the problems they have with understanding is the kind of the syntagmatic level of the passage. What does it mean? What's it all about? How does it fit together? If the translator has denied them the responsibility of offering that, they are simply replicating in the classroom the incomprehensible or difficult to comprehend nature of the original. And so what I've learned is that students will respond to passages or to works or to poems depending on whether the translation offers them a reading of the work as well as a version of the words.
Mm.
And if you want to further intercultural understanding and appreciation or whatever, it seems to me that the worst thing to do is to produce a translation that says in English that this doesn't sound as if it's worth spending your time on.
Yeah.
Why bother?
Why would you read it?
Yeah, why would you bother?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're translating a 10th century philosopher, one of the greatest minds of his age in Arabic, and you translate it into English, and the English sounds like someone that you wouldn't want to sit next to in the train for 10 minutes, let alone for a two-hour journey, you failed, it seems to me. You have failed.
Yeah, it has to be readable. But in a way, we've even got ahead of ourselves in talking about translation, because, of course, there's a massive step with classical literature to come first, which is editing.
Yes.
And in a manuscript tradition, there are choices to be made, choices, you know, between variations of a manuscript, which then the published work fixes a text that hasn't been fixed before. And I think with this type of poetry, there's an even greater problem, which is the fact it's an oral tradition.
Yes.
It was designed to be extemporized, to be adapted as it went, to have bits taken from one and merged into another and quoting famous people that came before you and all the rest of it. This tradition is rich, and by editing it down into an Arabic version, you've fixed something that has never been fixed before. How do you feel about that process?
You do your best to make it obvious that your version is precisely that. It is merely your version and not an authoritative version. What I decided to do, for example, was for each of these poems to choose one of the many versions that the scholars from within the tradition had themselves chosen, and to neither add nor subtract to what that scholar had himself presented as canonical or authoritative. So for some of the poems, you know, one scholar might have 10 verses more than another scholar's version, because they were editing just as much as I am. But the only thing you can do is to choose a fixed point and to stay true to that fixed point, because the moment you then think, oh, that fixed point doesn't satisfy me, I know that this word, I think this word from this other fixed point fits better in here, you have created a new version, right? So I often say to my students and my collaborators, stick with the version in the manuscript, even if it doesn't make as good sense as a version elsewhere, because all you're really doing is presenting the version in your chosen manuscript to the public. Otherwise, you are creating yet another version that's unauthorized within the tradition. We are all kidding ourselves on if we think that we actually have access to, let's say, you know, the excerpt that I read at the beginning by Shanfara. Access to his words, I don't know. We don't have access to Shakespeare's words. They're all mediated. The job is to mitigate the mediation by not creating another level, and to identify the mediation by making it clear to the reader that there are various steps of mediation in the process.
Yeah.
So it's trying to be as honest as you possibly can. And also, to go back to our visible-invisible distinction, to be as invisible as possible in your engagement with the manuscript.
But also what I'm hearing is you're in a line, you're in a tradition of this poetry.
Yeah.
That it has been fixed before many times.
Yes.
And you're just another version of this.
Yeah. And it's been fixed by scholars who are better Arabists, had access to more sources, had better linguistic training and linguistic aptitude than I. So who am I to kid myself on that I know more than, let's say, a Zolzani or a Ladbari or one of those other great scholars from the past? As And to think that you do is to do them a disservice. And it seems to me to be a supreme act of arrogance that is totally out of step with, I think, how we want to view the past in 2024 with all of the political discussions about engagement with the past and appropriation of the past and misrepresentation of the past and so on.
Well, we haven't even got on to your exceptionally brilliant translations of this, I think, 6th century warrior, Antara.
Oh, yes.
Who was a black slave freed. And then your beautiful translations of Al-Hamsa, a female poet who I think another one, she just lived into the Islamic period, didn't she? Another one spanning that cusp. But with all, we've only touched on a couple of books of hunting poetry, but with all that poetry that you have, I don't know what the word is, but let's stick to translated.
Yeah. No, you can't call them translations. I'm happy with calling them translations.
Good.
The stuff that I did in my
academic,
that my academic alter ego produced before 2010, I wouldn't call translations.
Well, I can tell you, well, you already know, but what gives you license to say that for me is the reactions of contemporary poets, not Arabists. So the American poet who you know, Peter Gizzi, who was a finalist in the National Book Awards one year for his poetry, he wrote to me saying, James has knocked it out of the park.
Yeah. And, well, that's very kind.
Well, and the brilliant British writer, poet Alice Oswald has agreed to write the introduction for the English-only version of the latest hunting poetry. Peter said to me, he has a terrific ear and a deep sympathy for the work. And so you are succeeding amongst the poets who are a very hard crowd to please. And so for me, these accolades are just huge. Has it tempted you, having said that your 18-year-old self wanted to be a poet, has it tempted you to be to write your own poetry?
No.
Why?
I don't know. It just hasn't. I think perhaps there's a natural reticence there that led me to go down the scholarly line in the first place. But actually what I really love the most is the words of the Arabic poets give me the vehicle, give me the creative vehicle. And so I don't feel the need, or I haven't felt the need yet. And I very much doubt that I will, to be honest, because I think that each version of each new poem that I embark upon gives me the challenges, emotional, aesthetic, intellectual, imaginative, creative, that I seem to need. And I don't feel any deficit. That gives me everything that I'm looking for at the moment. That might change, but I doubt it.
James Montgomery, thank you very much. You can buy James's translations of hunting poetry and indeed many other translations of classical Arabic texts from the Library of Arabic Literature. This week's episode was produced by Joshua Martin and Finbar Anderson and hosted by me, Lydia Wilson. For more like this, subscribe to The Lead on your favourite podcast app or visit our website, newlinesmag.com. Thank you all for joining us.